Welcome to this edition of Journals of Spiritual Discovery, brought to you by spiritualteachers.org. I'm your host, Sean Nevins. Hello and welcome to Journals of Spiritual Discovery. I do want to mention before we start with this episode that I will be giving a talk on Sunday, October the 5th in Eugene, Oregon. That talk is taking place at the Center for Sacred Sciences in Eugene. And if you are in the area, I would certainly hope that you could actually come by and see that talk in person. But if not, they will also be doing a Zoom broadcast of that event. Check out centerforsacredsciences.org or just Google Center for Sacred Sciences. And again, I hope that you could make that. It's at 11 a.m. Pacific time, Sunday, October the 5th. So this episode is going to be a little different. It is a Q&A. And I asked some weeks ago for listeners to send in questions, and I would do my best to give some answers or at least some thoughtful commentary. I've never done anything like this before, and it certainly promises to be a lot more talking than I would normally do on a podcast. Generally, I enjoy asking questions of my guests and doing as little talking as possible. We'll see how this goes. I'll just jump right in. I've got several questions here. The first of these, I'll just say I really appreciate this listener who sent in this question, because they sent a long email, a long and very thoughtful email about how they've been wrestling with this issue. The core question: what is the balance between striving for an exemplary life and letting go of striving of any kind? Just to give you a little of the background that they provided, they mentioned Angelo Duillo, I believe is his name, and a talk that he gave about doership is exactly what is relinquished when awakening occurs. And the questioner wrote, "I get the concept that the essence of awakening is experiencing that there is no doer. There is no need to leave any kind of mark in one's life, and there is nothing to hang on to. The body and the sense of being a separate self is an illusion woven from patterns, memories, and thoughts that are rooted in the past. And I can't force this massive shift in identity. I've practiced for years and I've had many glimpses into non-dual awareness. I frequently experience a quiet mind and contact with a vastness that is out of time, and here I am. How do I fully engage in doership, taking care of myself and doing all of the necessary life maintenance activities, while at the same time constantly reminding myself that there is nobody here to take care of?" He mentions that after a few years of intensive practice, he recently saw that the practice routines themselves were a barrier. "I quit my primary practice, and while I continue to take care of business on a daily basis, I let myself fully question my attachments and feel into the delusions I held about life. Within 6 weeks, under the pressure of some stressful experiences while traveling, I had a meltdown. I became angry, bitter, reactive, and thoroughly unhappy. I saw clearly that I had devolved, and my life was visibly worse than it had been when I was doing daily spiritual practices. My garden of awareness and connection to the divine had become choked with weeds. I woke up to the fact that, God damn it, I had to get my head back in the game and start taking care of myself. Life matters. Most importantly, I have to be emotionally regulated and at least somewhat centered to relieve the suffering I cause to others. I also realized I had become seduced by the ideas presented by Angelo Duillo and others, and these ideas began to undermine my actual experience of living here on Earth. Not only was I not enlightened, I quickly became very unhappy, and I was, in fact, dancing with decline and unhealthy unraveling while entertaining ideas of letting go of the delusion of the ego. So my question, again, what the hell do we do with our very necessary doership routines while we are waiting at the threshold of awakening, an awakening that may never come? Is spiritual practice a delicate balance between being open to nobody is here while at the same time taking care of myself, who is very much here? I really appreciated seeing the thought process of this questioner who, to a large degree, by the end of their email, had answered their own question in that last line. Is spiritual practice a delicate balance between being open to nobody is here while at the same time taking care of myself, who is very much here? And I say yes, and that is a large part of what spiritual practice is. It's very useful for all of us to hear, and I can certainly relate to reading ideas about enlightenment or awakening and thinking that I should be a certain way, or through some mental manipulation, I can sort of lever myself into awakening or enlightenment. But that is not how it works. I think Richard Rose, one of his core ideas was backing away from untruth and how we can't postulate what enlightenment is, because if we do, we're essentially creating a picture of something that's our imagination versus reality. Being open to nobody is here. That really is a powerful way to approach this. To be open to the idea, the possibility that the truth may be that all that I know myself to be and understand myself to be may not be true. Yet that doesn't mean that I am going to not feed myself in the morning. I'm not going to get a good night's sleep. I'm not going to go to work the next day. I'm not going to take care of my family. Doesn't mean that, but it means being open to possibilities. So thank you for that question. I really feel like you did answer that one yourself as well as I could have answered it. So thank you for sharing that with everyone. Another question that came in, and they wrote, another thing that was on my mind was, how does a seeker tread water? And this is an idea that I talk about in my book, Subtraction. At the very end, there's a chapter called Spiritual First Aid, and I mention developing the ability to tread water. And they wrote, I go through bouts of being up only to be followed by a down with some backsliding thrown in for good measure. It is easy to feel like I'm on a spiritual path when I'm fighting some negative traits or tendencies or seeing some glaring precipice of identity to back away from. But when that is gone, I feel lost, unenamored with my path, struggling in direction into what seems just vagueness. I get addicted to the pendulum swings because it feels solid. I don't believe I've ever got flung out from that pendulum swing into any real prolonged period of just treading water. So I am intrigued by this term, to tread water. It is not as easy or overlookable as I had first assumed when seeing that term years ago. So, yeah, I would say that to tie this into what you wrote, treading water is that place where my normal approach to the spiritual path isn't working. I'm not excited. You use the word feeling lost or unenamored. You've lost your connection to the thread of inspiration or to the thread of curiosity. And what do we do in those moments? I will often go back to examples from physical activity, right? Like working out. You've got your workout routine down, but you don't feel inspired. You really don't want to go. And it's pretty easy to flip into, well, I'll just skip today and I'll just skip tomorrow. And then before you know it, the habit's broken and you haven't worked out in 3, 4, 5 weeks. You go regardless of how you feel, and that is treading water. You're essentially holding the line of your practice until some new inspiration appears. It may feel like nothing's happening, but if you stick to your routines, stick to your habits, you can prevent backsliding and losing time from falling out of your habits. Because you might say to yourself, well, what does backsliding even look like on a spiritual path? The whole path itself, it's not like working out. It's not like, I did sit-ups for 4 weeks and now I feel like my abs are a lot stronger. And now I haven't done sit-ups for 2 weeks and my abs feel weaker. Spiritual path is generally not like that. It's not like, well, I did my meditation every morning for the past 6 months and now I feel like my brain is stronger and I'm more powerful, or I'm further along on my spiritual path. But I found that the backsliding that generally occurs is more, it's more on a subtle energetic level. You know, it goes back to Rose's concept of a vector, and that we are in our path creating a vector, a direction for our energy. And the more that we can point that in one direction, the more potent, let's say, that vector is. And the more we're essentially saying to the universe, whatever is out there, this spiritual path, spiritual question, this quest is the most important thing to us. It's like we preserve a space into which an inspiration can fall and be heard. And I think that last part is what's key. And be heard, because God, the universe, angels, whatever it is, our higher self, is always speaking to us. But our mind is generally too clouded with thoughts, too clouded with plans for the future, too crowded with desires for this and that, to have the space to hear. The more that we can hold our vector, keep to our practice, the more that we allow that space to be present and allow the possibility of hearing our next inspiration. In my experience is that the inspiration always eventually comes. All right, so thank you for that question. See, there was another listener who sent several questions. I'll take a whack at these. These are maybe a little more conceptual, but I'll try to feel into what's behind these questions and what the questioner was perhaps really trying to get at. Question one, how to see, then realize the not-to-ness of opposites. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, and this is conceptual, however, is Benoit's conciliatory principle. And I think that's what this reader is really asking about. So Benoit had the illustration of a triangle, and at the base of the triangle, there were two opposites. So let's say apparent life and apparent death, right? Those are two opposites. And what is the reconciliation of those two opposites, life and death? If we could hold those two thoughts, ideas in our mind at the same time, we may find a place or a space from which a, not really a merging, but a third way emerges. And that for, in Benoit's illustration of the triangle, your base of the triangle was the two opposites, and at the apex of the triangle was the conciliatory principle. And so this question is, this question is saying, hey, how do I do that? Just tell me how that's done. You know, how do I hold in my mind the feeling of my life and the feeling of my death? Or someone close to me, let's say, or a pet who in one moment was alive and with me, and then I saw them pass away into a different state, into death. How do I ride those two feelings? How do I hold those two feelings? I'm trying to feel my way into explaining that, into what it is to experience both those things within seconds of one another, and to feel in some way that there is a third, there is an alternative, there is something that transcends life and death. And I wonder if the questioner could find two opposites that had that sort of feeling for them, that weren't just, that weren't conceptually interesting or a curious thing to think about, but something that had real powerful emotion behind two opposites. And if they could allow themselves to feel deeply those two opposites, and essentially almost like rolling a marble between your two hands, the consideration or the feeling of those two states, rolling that back and forth in the mind, and feeling for some moment of relief, maybe is the word, feeling for some moment of uplifting in that mix of, let's say, sadness and joy. There's some hint of peace. Maybe that's a way to feel into that realization of the not-two-ness of those opposites. So question number two is just about as difficult to try to provide an answer to. How to notice the background? How to notice the background? I think that what they're asking about is what we many of us probably have a feeling for now and then, or an experience of now and then, that there's something behind all of this apparent motion, action, doing. There's some stillness. There's a background. Patty Ann Rogers had a poem called The Background Beyond the Background. And that's what she's pointing to, is this greater whole that is holding all things. And of course, that's just a concept, right? How do we notice it? How can we experience it? You know, something that I have been doing and finding a lot of value to is just taking five minutes a day and just sitting and doing nothing, but having a view that I can look at has been helpful for me in making this very apparent, this background very apparent. And by view, I mean not sitting in front of a blank wall and doing wall staring for 5 minutes, but finding a window or doorway, a patio, something where I get a little view of distance. I can look into the distance a bit and get my gaze focused outside of where typically in a day most of my gaze is within 4 or 5 feet of myself. Letting my gaze go further, relax, and literally doing nothing. Like, I don't have a journal, I don't have a recording device, no pen, paper, nothing, just sitting. And if some great idea comes to me in that space, I just ignore it. And a feeling, a sense of the background almost inevitably arises in that. I do think that is it's a very specific practice that I've outlined. And with all practices, you have to experiment with it and find some variation that works for you. So maybe for you, staring at a blank wall would do it, or staring at a mirror, or staring at your pet cat, or you get the idea, right? There's a general concept there, which I think is pretty core, of letting ourselves do nothing for a few minutes each day so that something can arise other than our ordinary mental consciousness. Question three, which I think is related to this, how to see the emptiness behind your head. So they're essentially asking about Douglas Harding's headlessness. As many of you probably know, Douglas Harding has any number of experiments, as he called them, where he helps you turn your attention to the space or the place where we think in our imaginations that we have a head. But, for example, his little pointing finger exercise makes it pretty apparent, if you go by present evidence, that the space where you imagine that you have a head is actually a vast, open, clear spaciousness in which all things are arising. So how to see the emptiness behind your head? Number one, I would recommend exploring Harding's ideas because they very quickly turn your attention behind you. Also, if you haven't looked at John Wren Lewis's material, Wren Lewis doesn't have much in the way of advice of what to do or directions to look, but he does have some very beautiful descriptions of his awakening experience. And I found that those gave me a sense, a Douglas Harding-like sense of there's something behind. There's something in back. There's some direction that I could almost be pulled into or fall into. Place of emanation, perhaps. And that is what this question is getting at. How to see that emptiness behind your head. Question 1, 2, 3, 4. Does an ant have a self? If not, then why do you? I would say yes, an ant does have a self. So maybe that's just an easy way for me to get out of the second half of that question. If not, then why do you? I think humans have a lot of hubris about their self and feeling that they are very special and that most of their human qualities are actually just animal qualities that we share with many, many animals, and for all I know, with plants as well. I've watched many a little spider in my time, for example, do a lot of planning in terms of where it is going and what it's after. Now, I guess I could flip it entirely and say that, if we're going to say that an ant doesn't have a self, because we're going to say that, well, that ant's planning is just instinctual, then I would say the exact same thing of a human, that what we believe is our self and what we believe is our will is just instinct and is just as instinctual as that of an ant. Question 5, and this is the last one from this listener, how much can you actually control? From a practical standpoint, I've never been one. This question borders so much on do we have free will, which is a question that I think a lot of people waste a lot of time on, frankly. You know, my beliefs or my practical experience in the spiritual path is that I will assume that I have control. I will assume that I can make choices. I will assume that I am going to choose to read this particular book today or listen to this podcast or do a meditation or go see a lecture or teacher, whatever. All these things that I lump as part of a spiritual path, that I have some control over those, and I'm going to exercise my will. I'm going to build a vector, as Rose would say. And I think that's a key part of becoming, is that we are going to make choices. That we could go left or we could go right, and we're going to make a choice to go right in a direction that feels like it has more potential for discovery to answer the deepest questions in my life. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? Or whatever for you is the deepest question that you want an answer to. Well, I feel like, how much can you actually control? I mean, it's easy to use that question to just kind of self-sabotage whatever you're trying to do and throw up your hands and say, well, I'm just going to let go. I can't do anything. It's kind of like that, the questioner who was asking about doership and listening to Angelo Duillo talk about doership is what gets relinquished. And, oh, well, then I should relinquish doership. Well, you saw where that took him into a place that was much worse in terms of life experience than what he was what was happening when he was doing his spiritual path. At the same time, right, just like the questioner realized, there's a delicate balance between being open to nobody is here while at the same time taking care of myself, who is very much here. We can consider and feel into the idea, how much do I actually control? And do experiments, right? Do meditations, watch. An exercise I often have people do is just pay attention to yourself speaking, myself right now. If I pay attention to my speaking, can I actually claim that I'm controlling in some way these words that are coming out of my mouth, coming out of my brain? Or is this just happening? And there's a lot of our apparent choices and actions in life that when we look at them moment to moment to moment, what is happening, it appears that we aren't controlling them. And that's a very powerful exploration to do. But that experiment and experiential real life understanding is very different from someone sitting in their armchair and saying, well, you know, I don't really control anything, and I'm just going to throw up my hands and let God take over. Two very different attitudes or approaches. And one, I think, the experimental path can bear fruit. And the other is just kind of an intellectual dead end. All right, well, thank you for those questions. Let's see what else we have. I believe I have a couple of more questions. Here's one. I've been recently rereading Richard Rose's Direct Mind Experience. On page 78, he talks about the reverse vector and says you should ask what is untrue, what is absurd or ridiculous for you. I have a very persistent mental knee-jerk reaction to certain thoughts that I've been working on for years. I know it's absurd and ridiculous. I've explored numerous reasons for it. Pride, feeling a lack of control, a lack of self-respect, among others. It has lessened over the years, but I'm still trying to find the root cause of the reaction. And I appreciate the reader. They explained more about the apparent cause of the reaction. I really appreciate them sharing that. I won't share those details. They continued, my questions are as follows. How will I know if and when I find the root cause? How do you know if what you're doing to find the root cause is backing away from untruth or if it's just psychoanalysis? Do I even need to find the root cause? Is understanding the trigger and response enough? Great question, very practical question, which I appreciate. And this reminds me of, I also wrote in Subtraction in the spiritual first aid portion of that book. I think I also wrote about having the discernment to know when let's call it a psychological block or a psychological reaction is something that you really need to change versus something that you could live with, that it's okay. And, you know, for myself, to use an example, let's say that I am afraid of spiders. I mentioned spiders earlier and noticing how intelligent they are. Let's say I'm afraid of spiders. When I see a spider, I scream every time I see a spider. Now that can be very irritating to me, maybe to some people around me. It can be embarrassing to me. I can wish that I didn't do that. I can try to figure out. I can try to observe. I can try to explore my childhood. I can explore past lives. There's almost endless exploration of this mental landscape that I could do to try to find the root cause in the belief that in finding the root cause, there'll be some release from that reaction. A couple things come to mind. One is that for what I'm trying to achieve in life, is this mental reaction that I'm experiencing in some way hindering me? If I become fearless, does that mean that I'm going to find the answer to my questions? I'm going to become enlightened if I become fearless. If you have that assumption, it's a good one to ask. Are there certain prerequisites for enlightenment? Well, I've got to overcome all my fears, or I've got to not have any habitual reactions. I've got to appear a certain way. I've got to be really nice to all people around me. All these different qualifications that I must meet. And once I do, I will therefore deserve enlightenment. You know, and I would say for this person, what is it that really bothers you about this particular reaction? Right? It's something that you've been working on for years and trying to get to the root in hopes that you will be relieved of the reaction. Is the reaction hindering you? Is the reaction something that you think your life would be that much better without it? Is the reaction somehow you think less of yourself because you have this reaction? You know, there can be a lot of judgment connected around these qualities that we want to change about ourselves. And where does that judgment come from? Is the judgment itself something to back away from? You know, there can be a lot of freedom in accepting that, hey, this creature, this self, interestingly enough, has this fear of spiders. Okay, I can live with that. I can forgive myself for having that quirk. It's okay. They ask, do I even need to find the root cause? Many times, no, it's not necessary. Now, there are certain reactions that maybe we do find are a hindrance. We do have some sense that this is slowing me down, that this is something that I've got to get to the root of. In that case, well, how do you know when you've gotten to the root? Just thinking about my own experience, I think that there's only been a few times, I think, where I felt like I got to the root of a reaction, and I got an understanding of that reaction and the whys of it. But I found that that didn't necessarily mean that the reaction instantly went away. There may have been a sense of relief, a sense of like a lightening, like Paul Hederman would say, like a traveling lighter kind of a feeling. But it didn't necessarily mean that the reactive pattern itself vanished. Maybe it was much less. Maybe I didn't care about it anymore or cared about it much less. How will I know when I get to the root cause? Well, of course, everybody's different. I'm sure there are many people who have had experiences of getting to the root of some sort of psychological knot, and they were then free from the reactions. I just can't say from my own experience that I've had that happen. So how will I know if and when I find the root cause? I think you'll know that there is at least a feeling of relief or lightness when you find that root. How do you know if what you're doing to find the root cause is backing away from untruth or if it's just psychoanalysis? I guess I have a hard time distinguishing between backing away from untruth and psychoanalysis. I think psychoanalysis is backing away from untruth, and backing away from untruth is psychoanalysis. But I may not have a professional understanding. I'm not a psychoanalyst. You know, I guess I would say my hope and my understanding is that psychoanalysis at its best is trying to get to the root and is trying to get to the truth of what's happening. One last piece to this question, which I think it's helpful to hear. This questioner also articulated that for this particular issue, they said, "I also feel it is something that needs attention, as it wouldn't continue to be thrown in my face, although not as often as in the past." So that is, when these reactions come up again and again, you do have to think to yourself, well, there must be something to this, otherwise it wouldn't keep coming up over and over again. I'm not going to sit here and say, no, I think you're wrong about that. You got the feeling that this needs attention, then you got to give it attention. You got to explore it. Now, the piece about this person has been exploring this for years and it sounds like they've seen some progress on it, but it's still what they describe as a sticky mental reaction. What might help them? I think some of the things that I said might help them, that you may have some feeling of the root cause. And it may be that because you're still having the reaction, you think that, well, I haven't gotten to the root of it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be having the reaction. But maybe if, when you dig into it experientially, you may find that there is some feeling of lightness there. And maybe you can explore that feeling, if it's coming up, explore that feeling of loosening or lightness, traveling lighter. And also that idea of forgiving yourself. I do think that is a powerful piece of these reactions that we're often burdened by. It's forgiving yourself for having the reaction. All right, that brings us to the end of the questions that I received. I hope that all of us found some value to this. I know that I certainly appreciate the questions that came in. As always, when I give a talk or am I having a conversation with anyone, I think I learn as much as they do in all those interactions. So I really, really deeply appreciate people being willing to share. Thank you so much for making this possible. If you enjoyed this episode, then please send some questions and we'll do another Q&A. You can always contact me via spiritualteachers.org. There is a contact form on the website. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me. And I will collect another set of questions if I get enough interest and do another one of these Q&A episodes. So thank you all again. And until next time, I wish you the best and take care out there. Thank you for listening to this edition of Journals of Spiritual Discovery. I'm your host, Sean Nevins. For more information about today's guest, as well as more interviews, books, and other resources, go to spiritualteachers.org. That's spiritualteachers.org.